Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Unauthorized Disclosure Podcast. I'm Kevin Gastola, and joined by my co-host, Rania Kalik. Hey, Rania.
Hey, Kevin.
And we're pleased to have back on the show Todd Miller, who is he works on the Border Chronicle newsletter. You're based in Arizona, and you do a lot of work covering the U.S.-Mexico border and chronicling life around the border. You're also the author of the book Build Bridges, Not Walls. So welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Kevin. Great to be back on here with you both.
And you've been very kind to us in the past. You're a longtime supporter of our show, so we're really happy to be able to speak with you. And let's get right to it.
I listened to the first show you ever did.
How long ago was that? Like 8 years ago. Jeez,
8 years ago.
Eight,
yeah, yeah.
Nine?
Yeah.
I don't know. A long time ago.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know how to take it, but I was able to peek into Spotify's glitzy wrapped thing for our podcast. And apparently we picked up a 25% or there's some huge segment of our listeners that just come from this year. So I don't even think that half the people who listen to our show are people who were around 6 or 7 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. We're the original podcasters.
Our audience, our listeners have changed so much. So let me ask you about this news that's coming out about President Joe Biden's administration and how they're going to fight in the courts for Title 42 at the U.S.-Mexico border, and what that means for the work that you do on the ground around the border. But also, maybe just we should probably basically outline what Title 42 is, the public health measure that was instituted by under Trump during the pandemic, and then how it's been manipulated in order to facilitate the deportations of people who are seeking asylum.
So Title 42, when it was implemented, and that was on, I believe it was on March 20th, 2020. So right when everything was getting going with the pandemic. They called for rapid expulsions. So if somebody crossed the border, and this goes for asylum seekers or people crossing through the border, a lot of people on the U.S.-Mexico border, and where I live in Arizona, they'll cross through the desert. So if a Border Patrol agent came across a group of people, instead of going through processing with Title 42, they do rapid expulsions. And that includes if a person wanted to ask for asylum. So instead of, they can't, it's like a double wall, right? A bureaucratic wall that then just called for people to be thrown back into Mexico, no matter where you're from either, right? So so that it's led along with a couple other policies in the Trump era, also continued by Biden policy of, it's often called Remain in Mexico, has just forced people back onto the Mexican side of the border. And so people will wait out asylum hearings, or sometimes the hope that one day there might be an asylum hearing on the Mexican side of the border. And that has led to pretty much, I would call, de facto refugee camps in any border city along on the Mexican side. And so Title 42 was I can't remember if Biden, when he was inaugurated, he made all these bold statements, right? And during his campaign, in 2020, there was all kinds of huge statements about the border, how he's going to clean up the border, the typical stuff you'd hear from the Democrats, right? Around Trump and Trump's wall and Trump this and Trump that and Trump the other thing. He put out an executive order about a number of different things. One was Remain in Mexico, the policy I just mentioned. I think it was more implied. It wasn't an executive order that he said they're going to stop this Title 42, the pandemic era policy that, was blockading asylum seekers. Not only that, it's part of I would contextualize it as part of a broader deterrence strategy policy the U.S. has been using on the border for decades. And this is just another, again, like another obstacle for people, a pretty significant one at that, and pretty treacherous and, you know, pretty brutal, right, when it comes down to it. And so Biden won, how long ago was it since he was inaugurated?
2 years ago, almost. It's almost been two years.
It's almost January. Been 2 years.
Yeah. A lifetime right? ago?
A lifetime ago?
Yeah.
Well, here we are 2 years later, and Remain in Mexico is there, and Title 42. So it was, the judge said you had to stop it, right? A judge, like a month ago. It was, there was a ruling saying, oh, Title 42, you have to stop this. And then the Biden administration said, oh, no, please don't do it. Give us until December 21st. That's what their initial response to the ruling of the judge was. And then the news this week is that they are appealing that decision by the judge, and now they are to prolong Title 42. In other words, I might have called it a Trump era policy at the very beginning. And at this point, it's like, I don't think that's probably inaccurate to say that, because now we're, as we just said, 2 years into the Biden administration. And it's very, and to see the Biden administration wanting to appeal this decision, it definitely seems like it's also a Biden policy at this point.
Well, yeah. Can you talk a little bit about that? So like what happened in terms of the court issue? Like what's going on here? So the Biden administration is trying to appeal this, like explain the sort of specifics about that.
Yeah. The specifics, unfortunately, the court ruling, the specifics of it. I just know that it's too bad my colleague from the Border Chronicle, Melissa Dubleske, is not on with us, because she has written on this extensively. So all I know is like, yeah, there's a court ruling saying to that this thing needed not to, you know, that we had to, the Title 42 had to be lifted. And that court ruling happened in November. And now I would just encourage people to go. There's a lot of articles on it to get all the specifics and the details on the actual court ruling, the judge, and all those different details. But basically, I mean, the judge said, and there was, and anyone who was paying attention at the time saw there was great jubilation for those like immigrant rights advocates, you know, all over social media. There's op-eds written about it and that sort of thing, about the fact that finally this thing's going to be off our backs. And then here we are, you know, I don't like the timeline of the appeal process, what that means. For what I understand, it means that Title 42 will just continue. It'll continue on throughout the entire entire process until some sort of resolution happens.
And then for the border under Biden, why don't we get into what it's been like under Biden, as we've seen. I know that one of the things we've talked to you periodically over the years has been focused on the way that surveillance systems are established around the border. And you've been very clear in making the point that what we're seeing is, even though the wall physically may not be built in the way that Donald Trump imagined it in his fantasies, there is this smart wall that President Biden supports and that Democrats support, and that is a bipartisan project that's unfolding. So I guess, what can you describe or outline as we do, assess what the last 2 years have been like in the United States at the border? What kind of projects are in development?
Yeah. So, one thing about, you know, when Biden again came into office, or during his campaign, he was like, we will not build one more foot of wall. Right. And that was That was a huge thing that he emphasized, his campaign emphasized. And then if you go into his, if you go into the initial documents of how he explained that his immigration and border policy was going to be during the campaign, they had a whole write-up on it. It said, I think one sentence was, we will not build 1 foot of wall. And by the way, that is not true. We can talk about that too. But the next part, there's a comma and I was like, oh, you know, you stop at that comma and go, oh, what are you going to do instead? Right. What are you going to do instead of, however, I forget how much Trump was paying. It was like $20 million per mile or something like that. Through his term, what are you going to do with all that money now? Like, what are you going to put it into healthcare? You know what, like, how could you, and we're not going to build one more foot of wall. But then he follows that by saying, we're going to instead invest that into technology. Like,
hello, everyone. I'm Kevin Gostola. I'd like to take a brief moment to ask you to become a subscriber of the Unauthorized Disclosure podcast. Just go to thedissenter.org. At the top, you'll see a black button that says subscribe. Click on it and you'll get options. And for $4 a month or $3, if you become an annual subscriber, you can get access to all of our premium episodes as well as any exclusive content that we post. Now, back to the interview.
Like, to go back to your question, the nugget of your question, Kevin, you know, that to understand the wall as one part of a bigger, broader system. And if you talk to the Border Patrol, they call it a border wall system. And that border wall system is composed of a border, they call it border wall, but also armed agents, Border Patrol, and others, and police, who they bring into their mission. And then technology is like a prong or a pillar, I should say, of that border wall system. So when the Biden administration says, oh, we're going to do technology instead of the border wall, well, they're saying they're doing the same thing, because it's the same thing, right? It's just the technology is meant to reinforce the border wall. So what we've been seeing over the last couple of years is pretty, should probably be way more out there in the world. It's pretty astonishing. About a year ago, I think it was in February of 2022, this year, the DHS released a big article showcasing a robotic dog that they had been testing in El Paso, CBP, Customs and Border Protection, and that was ready to be deployed on the U.S.-Mexico border. So there's a robotic dog, and I use that as an example. With that robo dog, I went to, there's an annual exhibition called the Border Security Expo that takes place in San Antonio, and it brings in like hundreds of private companies that are trying to sell their technologies to CB, you know, the border apparatus in the United States and elsewhere, foreign countries as well. The company was there, Ghost Robotics, that had the robotic dog, and the vendor was showcasing they had the actual dogs there, and they brought the dogs to, like, I was able to do a kind of informal interview of the vendor, and the vendor brought the dog up to me and had it wag its tail like it was super cute or something like that. Oh, and God. They had like these antennas on its behind, like that was a tail. And I remember right when when that was happening, another guy kind of stood to my side, and he started asking him. He was using a lot of like kind of military jargon, but he was plain clothes. But he said, can they be weaponized, right? And of course the vendor said, yes, they can be weaponized. And then implying that they were already weaponized on the border. So I asked him, are they deployed on the border? And he said, yes. But then I went then in the same place, I was able to talk to the Border Patrol chief, Raul Ortiz, and he said they weren't, right? So you have that kind of story, like, are they going to be deployed? Are they not going to be deployed? Still unclear if they are or not, But they've been tested. DHS is talking about them. And I think that's, if they're not deployed yet, they will be. And there's a kind of automation of the Border Patrol going on, that it's a UGV, right? With unmanned ground vehicles, that, and they're being used along the West Bank and is in Palestine, mm-hmm. Israel, Palestine. They're being used along the Gaza Strip. And in this, you know, they have a, I remember there's a, yeah, it's a, the UGVs, right? That's what they're called. And it's already being deployed on in borders around the world. And we're, and that, when I see that, when I saw the robotic dog, I then wrote a piece about it for the Border Chronicle. And it pretty much occurred to me while I was writing the piece, this is like Biden's wall, right? This is his wall, this robotic dog. It's what it symbolizes. Now you can see that there's other contracts for other drone systems, like CBP just gave out $1 million or so dollar contract to a company for medium and smaller drone systems, where, you know, agents can sit with tablets and control these drones. And so this sort of roboticization, if that's a word, I don't even know if it's a word, automation.
Automation.
I like the robotization. I don't know, but it doesn't come off my, come out of my mouth correctly. But automation of the Border Patrol, this kind of amping up of the technology, and those sorts of examples, bringing in camera systems with sophisticated, with cameras that can see really far away, like 8 miles away, really clearly, these radar systems, all of that is being enhanced, fortified, under the Biden administration. In fact, one last thing before I stop here, there was an Elbit Systems contract that was issued to CBP. Elbit Systems, of course, is the Israeli company who was showcased their technology that they were using on the West Bank as combat proven, right? In 2013, when there was a request for proposals by CBP, and they won the contract. It was like $140 million contract in 2014. I think they added more money onto it to build 50 or so surveillance towers in Southern Arizona. And they completed the last tower in this year in August. So that cycle has finally completed. And that was completed on the Tana'atam Nation, which is basically the Tana'atam reservation is right on the U.S.-Mexico border, and the Tana'atam land goes deep into Mexico. So it's one of the many, many examples of the border crossing people instead of people crossing the border. And so those towers by Elbit, those Elbit towers, and mind you, on the Atam Nation, on the Atam reservation, people regularly refer to it as occupied territory, just like in Palestine, right? And you hear that terminology coming from so many people, and there are 10 towers now completed there, started under Obama, continued during Trump, and now finished during Biden.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it once again seems as though there is certainly like a ongoing policy that doesn't really change between administrations. Perhaps the sort of rhetoric around immigrants shifts a little bit, right? Like when it comes to Republicans, it's much more hateful. When it comes to Democrats, it's like, no, we love them, but and we do see this like every time there's a shift in party who's in charge. And so you've obviously documented throughout these various administrations, even going back as far as Bill Clinton, how these policies have really like reinforced each other with each administration that comes. But I want to ask about when it comes to the Biden administration specifically. I mean, we had something happen in the last, I think it was like maybe a month or two ago, maybe it was like 2 months ago, where I'm sure you remember, Todd, all of the news media was talking about, oh, these people who are fleeing communist dictatorships, all of these immigrants are coming from Venezuela and Nicaragua and Cuba. And actually when people looked at the numbers, that was still the minority of people coming into the US. The majority were still coming from actually countries like Guatemala and Honduras and Mexico. But the reason I raise that is because I'm just curious what, like, the Democrats, their response to it, I remember it was the Democratic, or it was the spokesperson for Biden, her response to these like right-wing reporters being like, what do you have to say about these people fleeing communism, was they are in fact fleeing communism, and so we have to accept them. When there's actually this interesting policy of, like, I can't remember the exact name of it, but it basically gives special status to people from certain countries. And one of the special status, like, one of those countries is Venezuela. I believe another one is Cuba, in terms of people making it here. I'm curious if you could just talk a little bit about that, because I think it's really interesting how there are these countries the U.S. is obviously actively pursuing policies to try to ruin, especially their economies, you know, with the case of Cuba and the blockade, and obviously with Venezuela and Nicaragua, even though I don't believe there's as many people leaving Nicaragua. And in recent years, there have been people leaving those countries as a result, especially when it comes to Venezuela. And in fact, I think a lot of the people who are coming into the country now from these places actually left those countries years ago. It's not like they're leaving right this second. But that, I'm just curious, like, because then you also, you have on the one hand, special status for these places that the U.S. kind of wants people to flee. And then a place like Haiti, where it's quite the opposite, where that's, I think that a lot of people that Biden's deported have been from Haiti. And that hasn't changed. They haven't let up. I'm just curious if you can kind of talk about that contradiction and what that special status policy is about.
Yeah, it's pretty disingenuous. I think it's, yeah. Like, with Cuba, and they actually, they had the wet foot, dry foot policy. And this is what I, and that continued, I believe, until it was discontinued, actually, in a couple of years ago. But it's still the spirit of it is what you're talking about. And if you look at asylum claims and who's being awarded them, it's there's certain people from certain countries that are getting this asylum claims much, much easier. And of course, Venezuela is on the top of that list. And so is Cuba. Nicaragua is very much, you know, there as well. So there's a sort of way, you know, if there's a Venezuelan in immigration court versus a Honduran or Haitian, it's almost, it's not 100% by any means, but I don't have the numbers in front of me, but, you know, from all that I've heard and you can see, and I'm sure the numbers will back this up, is that, you know, people from these certain places do get this sort of special status. I can't remember if there's a certain name for them, that status or not, that, and it might apply for, you know, to individual countries, like the wet foot, dry foot policy for Cuba, which is basically that policy was that if you're from Cuba, you can't you quote unquote can't migrate to the United States. So if you're caught doing so, that you can be border patrol can stop you if you're on the water and then send you back to Cuba. But if you touch ground, then you're home free. Pretty much. So if you come in and you get in the United States, everything's good. So I see that sort of playing out, and it's so, I mean, then you get in what I think a lot of what you're talking about, Rania, is like the media narrative and the political, the Washington narrative that comes out, you know, that it's so interesting. Like you see it so across the media that and I talk about the conservative right wing media and the liberal media as well, right? That this, you know, the Venezuela dictatorship fleeing communism narrative, whereas on one hand, whereas Haiti, right? The impositions of the U.S. economic model, like we go back, you know, centuries really, but you can go back decades to, you know, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and the impositions of that the sort of United States backed economic policies and how devastating that has been to the rice, you know, to Haitian rice farmers, for example. And even Bill Clinton apologized for it, right? For the kind of free market shift to like opening up the market to Arkansas farmers when he was governor. I guess he was part of it while he was governor of Arkansas. And and how that flooded Haiti, just almost like corn in Mexico, right? After NAFTA, where the borders open up to corporations. This is what happens. Corporations flood into the place. I love that trope, the kind of flood of migrants trope that you always hear. Mm-hmm. Without that other part of it, you know, the flood of corporations and corporate power and whatever going into different places, imposing economic models, devastating like economies, especially for the poor, or driving people into poverty. And then that sort of narrative is never like, you could look at all that. You can look at Mexico, you can look at Honduras, you can look at Guatemala, you can look at El Salvador, on and on and on, and see how these policies and all these different places have played out. And then with Central, and also the military, right? The Central America is such a recent and such a sharp example of the United States funding, you know, dictators and armies and generals that went in and massacred their people. You know, in Guatemala, around the United Fruit Company, right? That's how it all started, the United Fruit Company. So a big Boston-based U.S. corporation exploiting Guatemalan land and people, you know, get to cultivate bananas and sell those bananas, ended up starting a 36-year-long oppression and civil war in Guatemala. Since it ended in 1996, it's not too long ago, right? There's still so much ramifications there. And none of that is like, when you're talking about immigration from Guatemala, like that stuff should be front and center, right? Like we should be looking at U.S. policy historically and contemporarily, and how, you know, look at how the borders have been open to corporate power and closed to people. And then what we hear, like you're saying, Rania, is how like people are fleeing from communist countries, and that's all you hear about. And which just like, it's just so disingenuous, and it ends up, it's like it's just a narrative that somehow takes hold in the national media, and gets repeated endlessly, and then it just, I don't know, obscures what's really going on, and it actually omits and hides, like the communism part. Then you have to talk about the capitalism. You have to talk about the capitalism, but then it plays out in policy, like you're saying, and that's the final thing. Plays out in policy, so people coming from certain places are, oh, you're doing that, so you can flee. You are fleeing an authoritarian dictatorship, so now you will be awarded asylum. But you in Honduras, of all places, you know, or some other place where there's, right, like, but you're not, right? So that it plays out into the policy very selectively in that way.
This is a good time to segue into a connected but, you know, larger topic about what we can do to prepare for these events that are going to spur great waves of asylum seekers and refugees coming to the country from like climate catastrophes. I want to ask you about COP27, but I'm sorry, I can't get this image out of my head after I put it on screen earlier of the ghost robotics dog. So I just have to call people's attention. Our viewers, listeners won't be able to see the image, but I had to put this back up on screen. And just, I found that article you were talking about, Todd, and when you were giving your description, I put some images up there. And I just want to point out that this says potentially a new best friend for CBP personnel in the field. This is from the Homeland Security article that was written. And I guess that's supposed to be the dog's face. It's really creepy looking. But my question, my serious question is about COP27, and you did some writing on this. This was the climate conference. And, you know, just like almost all of these conferences, they come and go and they don't get a lot of attention. Nobody expects much out of them. You get a few weeks to have a truly important discussion about things we could do for those populations, especially ones in the global south. And then people get back to the business as usual, and we don't have any movement. But, you know, there is an important point here that we should raise, and it's what we could do for people. And you talk about how there are new and additional mechanisms for financing that could be developed in order to help deal with people who are going through losses and damage from these catastrophes. Maybe you could get into that a little bit.
Yeah, if there's one thing about this year's the COP27 as opposed to other years, and mind you, I think what you said was spot on about the different UN summits, the UN summits every year. Like the Paris Accords, probably the most famous one from 2015, and at the end of the day, that was probably the biggest success that ever came out of one of these summits. And it's not even, you know, binding, right? Like that countries can agree to reduce emissions and all this stuff, but at that, it's not even binding, right? But one of the things that one of the more interesting developments, I think, that probably saw a little bit more in the COP27 that just happened, is that conversation around loss and damage. And loss and damage is basically the damage done due to climate change, particularly in poorer countries. And often loss and damage is trying to find a financial number to then say, oh, that was worth this amount of money. And then the whole idea is maybe to start one of those fund, a loss and damage fund of some sort. So the analysis that I've been working on with other people last year's the Glasgow one in 2021, that the COP26, I helped write up a report for the Transnational Institute, which is a Amsterdam based organization that has a kind of global scope on things, but we wrote a report called the Global Climate Wall. And basically what we did was take the top 10 emitters historically from 1850. And anyone guess who's number one? Yep. United States.
USA, USA.
Yeah, we're US wins that one, gold medal for the US. And really, you know, way above the second, right? Like when you take, and so really the second is if you take the European Union and you put all the different countries together. But when you separate the top 10, you have England and France and Germany and just a number of different places. Australia's in it, Canada, China, and I can't remember all 10, but that's most of the 10. And so what we did was we looked at that, and then we looked at how much money was being spent on border and immigration enforcement compared to climate action. And mind you, these countries, the rich countries in the world, had agreed over a decade ago I think in the 2009 summit, I should say, to pay into these climate action funds a lot of money, and they've been under paying for years and years and years and years. And so we looked at that, and we looked at climate, so we compared climate action funding to border, and then I give out, you can guess what we found. We found that border and immigration spending was, like, if you took all 10 of the countries, or we couldn't find information on China. There are some countries we couldn't find enough information on to include, but I think we were able to find on 8 of those 10 countries. And it was about 3-1 ratio, favoring border and immigration I believe these are undercounts to climate action. The United States was nearly 12-1 as far as looking at its budgets to climate action. And Canada was like 15-1. Australia was really high as well. And so the whole premise then was like, okay, you know, and then you look at the forecasts for, you see there's displacement already happening at rates. I believe there's 3 times more than war. People are being displaced for environmental reasons, mainly a lot to do with climate. It's hard to parse out sometimes exactly what is climate, but according to the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center, and that I think has the most accurate numbers, they report about 23 million people per year are being displaced due to climate. And that definitely is undercount because they don't know how to measure quite yet drought and some other what they call slow onset. And so the numbers are probably much higher, and they're predicted to be super high going into the next couple decades. And if you go to 2050, you know, the sort of assessment or the projections range from, the World Bank came out with a report saying 210 million people by 2050 would be displaced. There's a report out there that says 1.2 billion people. So the kind of numbers range pretty widely, but they're debated as well. But what the consensus is there's a lot of people that are going to be displaced because of this. And so one of the things that people have been pushing, and at the end of the day, we were trying to push with that report, was why the hell are we spending all this money on border and immigration enforcement? Like, and there's a whole, if you look into border, and like, if you go and look at DHS documents around it, the border, and you look at climate change, there's all kinds of stuff talking about building up our borders and talking about future displacement. So it's kind of baked in now, the border with future climate displacement. And so you look at that and go, why can't make it simple right now, the argument, why not put the money in border and immigration enforcement into a loss and damage fund? And then what, like, you could help whatever, you know, a sort of international loss and damage fund where it could be applied. I mean, of course that might come with its own problems. I know. So I don't, like, without going into like those problems that who's in charge of it, how does it get dispersed? Do the communities themselves have a say in how this is used, or is it imposition? Is it another imposition? If any of the latter, it's an imposition, then watch out, right? Mm-hmm. But in such a way where a community directs it and say, we need this, and we need this. Or, you know, what the World Bank says in their report is that people are going to be displaced from places and not be able to return ever, right? There's going to be the sea rising or desertification or something like that. So why can't money go into helping people move, right? Oh, you can move from this place to this other place instead of like building, you know, another border wall. And border walls are being built like freaking crazy, right? There's what, it went from 15 to 77 since the Berlin Wall was built, right? So it's this rapid rate of building border walls and all this border enforcement money. So the question is, like, why can't, like, given the climate catastrophe and what's in front of us, why can't the money be spent in elsewhere in some sort of more, you know, in a way that actually addresses the problem rather than, you know, putting down the iron fist on people that are on the move?
And what's the answer to that? why can't it? Seriously,
that is, yeah, why, like,
capitalism,
it, yeah, it's so amazing how baked in this idea that we need to have a border, you know, the border enforcement. Today on the Border Chronicle, we have a podcast coming out with Jenny Stumer, who's a who's a border scholar, but she works at this apocalyptic and post-apocalyptic center at the University of Heidelberg in Germany. And she's been studying movies and media and how movies depict, like, so like her research has looked at, you know, like World War Z with Brad Pitt, where I guess I haven't seen the movie myself, but she describes it. And she talks about, you know, how there's a pandemic. Oh, I think the movie came out in 2013 too.
Something like that.
It's old. But anyhow, it has a, like, people, all of a sudden people turn into zombies, and then Pitt finds that trying to save the world, right? and then he ends up in Israel.
Yeah.
And Israel's the only place that has, you know, that has built a wall around its country. So there's this, like, scene of
which
zombies.
By the way, does spoiler alert, the wall doesn't work. Just throw that out there.
Right. Yeah, so basically, right, the wall doesn't work, and then, but this sort of, like, there's apocalypse, this is her, Jenny Stumer's point is, there's apocalypse upon us, there's this, you know, well, there's, you know, you have this climate catastrophe, but then you have the Hollywoodization or the media rendering of it, where you have these, like, fantastical renditions of just playing on every, you know, very, you know, all the things that you could think about on migration, right? And ending up, like, with this conclusion very subconsciously that the wall is a savior, right? Whether it be a wall or border enforcement. And then it's like you go to the Washington, right? And you go, what can we get, like I have done this, like I go there and I say, oh, let's get rid of border security, and it's just like you swore or something, you know, like what did you say? You know, and it's so amazing how much such terms are said, like border security, and so it's said so endlessly, like you're in hypnosis, like you can't even think around it, like, oh, you can't even say it.
Almost
one time,
like
I
like a wall, I, almost like there's like a wall, a border wall preventing you.
Yeah, precisely. There's a border wall, and then you say, what, stop border security, it's like penetrate the border.
So
one time I googled like Democrats, I don't agree with the border, no, I'm against the border wall, but border security is, and then there's so much came up. Like border security is important, right? And so that sort of like ingrainedness, you know, that how can we think of a world without having these things, is so ingrained and so unquestioned. And so, like, I feel like if people actually sat down, looked into the budgets, looked at all the different things, looked at what the wall does, look at what the technology does, look at why people are leaving in the first place, like climate change. If the U.S. is the highest emitter, doesn't there some sort of responsibility there, right? Or economic, you know, or more, you know, all the different stuff. None of that stuff. It's the way it's rendered in the media so often, like people just appear at the border, right, out of a complete vacuum, like nothing happened here. That here they are, you know, and so the kind of conversation around it is disgusting. It's like so shallow and so doesn't go into it. And then you have, like we're just saying, those movies or media or, you know, how politicians talk about it and are afraid to even question border security. And then it just had, and on top of that, the border industrial complex, right, with all the companies and the lobbying and all that other stuff. You have like this thing that's just lives on its own, right? And it just increases and increases. And it seems like, all right, well, yeah, you could talk about stopping it, and you could talk like the Democrats did, like, let's tear down the, you know, let the wall is bad. But then if you come into office and you just continue it, then what are we all supposed to think, right?
Right.
Well, so as we wind this down, I just have one more thing to throw at you. And we don't have a lot of time to get into this when we have you back on the show and your colleague Melissa at the Border Chronicle joins us. Maybe we can get into this in more detail, but I think about what you're saying and, you know, the concept of defund the police turns Democrats apoplectic. The Republicans think that the purge is coming in the U.S. I think the equally analogous kind of thing that we hear related to immigration is open borders. And when you hear the idea of open borders, you get the same thing. And I think that like Republicans literally imagine that like World War Z would happen and like the zombies are coming over the border. And that's how they view those in Mexico who are trying to get into the U.S. And, but you know, I think if you want to try to like get people to understand why you might want to move away from a border system, that's something that your newsletter is doing. And you delved into this, the impact of this psychologically on people, the health issues that people can go through. And you were having a very wide discussion on your newsletter about something called wall sickness. And it's something I had not ever contemplated before. So I was hoping you'd take just a few minutes as we end here to introduce people to wall sickness.
Yeah, wall sickness. Actually, that was for a term that first came out of Berlin in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. I think in the 80s, it was even a diagnosis that was used by some psychologists and psychiatrists, wall sickness, right? The original, you know, the people who would live near the Berlin Wall would describe this feeling of feeling isolated, feeling extra anxiety, feeling narrowness, one person put it. And there's a book that came out called Wall Disease, but I believe the author is named Jessica Wapner. In her book, she talks about border brain cells, like for people living too close to walls. And now, of course, again, when the Berlin Wall fell in 89, there's 15 border walls. Now there's 77, you know, so the increase of border walls and where they are. And of course, where I live, I just go 60 miles to the south and there's a 30-foot wall for me to look at and walk near the houses that are right alongside the wall and the people that have to deal with the wall on a daily basis. And not only the wall itself, the aggressiveness, like the wall is almost this inanimate object, but it's not, right? It's aggressive. What it symbolizes the border patrol can go in your house, and they do. They'll do home invasions, and those extra, and the surveillance, the technology all around, like always having cameras. Like in Nogales right now, that's another technology I forgot to mention. They have an aerostat that was deployed in June, an aerostat surveillance balloon, with all these cameras that are right over in Nogales neighborhood. So people walking around, so people talk about feeling watched all the time. And that's, you know, that part of this, I would say like probably enhanced wall sickness that we would describe it as now. And the border brain cells are cells, if I understand correctly, they're like neurological pathways that are overly stimulated by being around this stuff. And then symptoms become manifested as these pathways are more activated, and so this is a part of it. I would like even, you know, I would encourage people to go back to that discussion on the Border Chronicle. It's on wall sickness, because we brought in panelists that went pretty in-depthly into it. And one of the panelists, Kenneth Madsen from Ohio State University, he's done a ton of research on it, and he has all these, you know, links to it of they call it wall disorder. There's all different ways of and different manifestations of how it might manifest, how it might come to be. But he has a number of different like sources if people were interested in looking more into it. But last thing I want to say about that is that I think it's now at this point, what I've seen, you know, it's way past the border area itself. You could see it like the whole thing we were just saying about border security and mentioning in Washington and people freaking out, right? That to me, that's wall sickness, right? You got wall sickness in Washington, and it's just ingrained in you know, it's in, it's like in our discourse, of like this perpetuation, this idea that we need a wall, you know, quote unquote need a wall. And at the same time, this what the wall actually causes the people living around it. And that and one last point, Jenny Stumer, and that's the person who is talking about like World War Z, right? And the you know, how it's depicted in the movie, the wall is alleviate like these anxieties, right? And often nationalistic anxieties or white anxiety, you know, those sorts of anxieties that are quote unquote solved by building a wall. Well, when in reality, living near a wall or a wall itself is causing all these other just disorders and problems, which offers an interesting sort of paradox to think about.
Well, thank you, Todd. We really appreciated it. And I got your newsletter website address on our screen here. And those, for those of you who are listening, it's thebordercronicle.com as a newsletter. Support this journalism and what you're building. These are people who are journalists that are on the ground at the border. They're not making up policy ideas from a very comfy room in DC or like a, you know, like a, an office in Capitol Hill or something. These people are, you're out there, you know what's going on, these systems that are being built at the border. So it's good to talk with you, Todd.
Yeah. Thanks so much. It's always a pleasure to be talking to you. And I'm so glad that 8 years later that you're still here, kicking it. Right. So thank you.
Once again, I'm Kevin Gastola, co-host of the Unauthorized Disclosure podcast, asking you to become a subscriber of the Unauthorized Disclosure show. All you have to do is go to thedissenter.org, select the option to subscribe to the podcast for $4 a month or $3 if you become an annual subscriber, and then you'll get access to all the content we post week to week, our entire interviews, premium episodes, and any exclusive content. It's all yours, and you can support our little independent show that we've been doing for nearly 10 years. Thank you, and we'll be back next week with another show.